My name is Don Rakow. I'm the Elizabeth Newman Wildes Director of Cornell Plantations. And before we get tonight's lecture underway, I'd like to share a few thoughts with you. The first of these is that all of you who are local or local to this area have been enduring the local public radio station's membership drive over the past week. I see lots of heads nodding. Given the fact that you and I have been enduring that, I do not plan to speak with you this evening about the fact that Cornell Plantations depends on members for over 30% of our annual budget. Nor would I even consider talking with you about the fact that members are the lifeblood of Cornell Plantations and are in fact the individuals who allow us to put on wonderful free series such as this. And it would be the height of hypocrisy for me to even deign to mention that you have the opportunity to become members this evening at the table outside or by going online to our website. So let's just agree that I haven't mentioned any of those things. But I would like to thank a number of parties and individuals this evening. And first and foremost, this is not only the sixth and final lecture in our fall series, it is also our annual Class of 1948 lecture. And I'm very pleased that we have at least 45. Thank you, Sonia. It's important to have staff who correct you. I am very pleased that we have at least one member of the Class of 1945 with us this evening, Lois Humphrey. And Lois, if you would please stand and be recognized. Two, three. So if you folks would please identify yourselves and be recognized. So we very much appreciate having the Cranches here. And Mrs. Raymond? Okay. Well, for the Cranches and for Mrs. Humphrey, we are very grateful to the support of the Class of 1945 and very glad to have you here with us this evening. And look forward to seeing you next year at this time. We would also like to thank our partners, the Statler Hotel, with whom we partnered for our very successful recent tea tasting with Michael Harney. We also greatly appreciate their making the Statler Auditorium available to us each fall. And also to Banfi's Restaurant for partnering and making those free appetizer coupons available. Hopefully many of you have taken advantage of that this fall. I'm afraid to say those coupons are of very little value other than as mementos after tonight. And speaking of the Statler Auditorium, we greatly appreciate one of our unsung heroes, Rick Wood, who records each of these lectures and then makes them available on CornellCast. So if you know individuals who live outside the area or are unable to come to these lectures, do let them know that all six of the lectures do appear a few weeks after being live on CornellCast, which you can find by simply going to cornellcast.com. We'd also like to thank our Cornell Plantations Lecture Series Committee, several of whom are here this evening. And I would like to thank my own Cornell Plantation staff who work so diligently on this series. Kevin Moss, Billy Kepner, Sonia Skelly, and the woman who created this series 25 years ago, Raylene Ludgate. And if Kevin, Sonia, Billy, and Ray would stand up, I would love to recognize all of you. 25 years just flies by, doesn't it, Ray? The final thing I will mention is that the Cornell Plantations Brian C. Nevin Welcome Center will remain open throughout the year, except for a brief hiatus during the month of January. And in this month, it is now November, on November 28th, we'll be having a special sale from 3 to 7 p.m., in which all items in the gift shop will be heavily discounted, and discounts will continue in the gift shop throughout the holiday season. So at this point, I would like to introduce Jane Milliman, who is the publisher of the Upstate Gardener's Journal, something that we at Plantations always turn to as soon as it comes out. And in fact, I believe our staff provided the November, December gardener's tips for Upstate Gardener's Journal. And Jane is here to introduce tonight's speaker. Jane.
Thank you. Yes, your staff did provide the almanac tips for this issue, and I appreciate that very much. Thank you. Michelle Owens, who is our speaker tonight, is, as you know, a garden writer, but in her actual real-world life up until becoming a garden writer and continuing on now, she's a speech writer, actually. And today at lunch, she told us that the optimum time for a speech is 16 to 17 minutes. Is that what you said?
Yeah.
So this is going to be a really short night. And my introduction will be also very short. I actually only met Michelle today, but I've known her by reputation for quite a few years. She is one of the four founders of Garden Rant, which is probably the most well-respected blog, gardening blog, definitely in the country, probably in the universe. So she's kind of a rock star in the garden blogging world, and I'm very excited to meet her. I loved her book. Grow the Good Life. Her argument in this book is that it doesn't take a lot of money. It doesn't take a lot of time, it doesn't take any chemicals, and it doesn't take a lot of tools. It's pretty easy to actually grow your own food, and the big question is, why isn't everybody doing it? So, I would like to welcome Michelle Owens. Thank you. Thank you.
So I want to make sure, first of all, everybody can hear me?
Yeah.
Okay, great. Thank you, Jane. So it's an incredible honor to be here at Cornell, because I make a point of pestering the Cornell plant scientists and various sort of ag revolutionary thinkers for new insights into my favorite subject, which is vegetable gardening. So I learned something interesting today, that Ithaca is 12 square miles surrounded by reality. And so I'm going to talk about reality tonight. So this probably doesn't apply to Ithaca, but you might find it interesting anyway. I'm going to consider why America is not a food growing culture, a backyard gardening culture. And I'm actually going to talk a bit about the class of 1945. So you can correct me about anything I've gotten wrong about that. Basically, as a garden writer, I consider myself an evangelical. Basically, I think this would be a much happier, healthier country if we all grew a little food in the backyard. So before I talk about the bigger picture, I want to introduce myself as a gardener. I started gardening 20 years ago because I dragged my husband out of New York in order to buy this house. And it didn't look like that when we bought it. I mean, it's obviously a beautiful piece of architecture, but it hadn't been painted in 35 years. And so it looks like this after we poured lots of money into it, a civic act for which I'm sure I will receive my reward in the afterlife. But anyway, it was a disastrous decision. My husband hated living in the country. This was on a sort of awkward corner in a village. We got lots of traffic noise. Our first winter there, it got down to minus 30 below for weeks in a row. I couldn't find a job in the uncongenial labor market of Albany. Things were not going well. But the single worst moment of that experience was going to the Grand Union for the first time in the dead of winter and looking at the offerings of the produce department. And so basically my choices were soft potatoes, wilted cabbage, rubbery carrots, or Harry Caray. So I decided right then and there, even though I'd never picked up a shovel in my life, that I was going to grow my own food. And so I did that. The next spring, I ripped a garden arduously out of the sod and I started. And so I started gardening because I'm a food person and I wanted good ingredients. And so I took beautiful food out of my garden in floods. But what really surprised me were the other things I took out of my garden. I discovered that I loved the exercise. I liked the way the garden looked. I liked the way it smelled. I liked sharing it with other creatures, including spectacular black and yellow garden spiders. I always felt happy in my garden. I felt a huge connection to the cycles of life. The other thing that surprised me about my vegetable garden was how beautiful it fit into the normal insanity of modern life. So from the time I made that garden, I worked like crazy at various jobs. I had three babies. I sold that house and bought two others. I acquired cats, dogs, hens, goldfish. And yet, I became so slick as a backyard farmer that every year I took more food out of my garden in less time. So this was my next garden. It was at a weekend house. To me, the most beautiful place on earth. 2,000 square feet, a sea of food, incredible. And I wouldn't even make it there every weekend. I just mulched heavily in spring, and the garden was basically self-sustaining, incredible. But I have three kids, and they this year made it absolutely impossible for me to get to that garden. So in a fit of pique, I made this garden in Saratoga Springs, which is where I lead my weekday existence. I made this garden on Memorial Day weekend, 3 days. My son helped me with the fence. You know, easy peasy, no big deal. It's not quite big enough for my taste at 800 square feet, but it still yielded a flood of food. So basically, my experience of the vegetable garden is that I've taken so much out of the garden for such limited effort on my part that I've harbored a secret opinion about non-gardeners, which is that they're crazy. And I think as a country, we're really arriving at this moment where it is crazy not to garden. I mean, we have the whole economic situation. I mean, you know, the worst downturn since the Great Depression. And as much as we'd all like to spend, like, you know, buy those, like, you know, however many dollar a pound, you know, organic tomatoes at the farmer's market, you know, a lot of people just don't have the money for it. In the meanwhile, of course, there's no bigger bargain on the planet than a package of seeds. We're also at a political moment where participating in our industrial food system is a total problem. It uses a tremendous amount of fossil fuels, you know, imported from ugly parts of the world. It's an ecological disaster. There was just a piece in Nature that said basically 35% of the world's greenhouse gases can be attributed to agriculture. And it, you know, because of the amount of artificial fertilizer we use in industrial gardening, you wind up with these hypoxic zones in the ocean, these dead zones the size of New Jersey. Just ugly. Meanwhile, the backyard vegetable garden requires nothing out of balance with nature. You don't need a drop of oil or a grain of artificial fertilizer. And finally, we're at this epidemiological moment where it makes sense to grow a few vegetables in the backyard. So, I mean, this chart is very simple, but to me, it's like the best evidence I can think of that our food culture is insane. I mean, how is it possible that like 20% of 6 to 11 year olds are now obese? So I know Ithaca is the great exception, but even though we have every reason to garden as a culture, if you drive around any suburb, you'll see how few people garden. I mean, this is a land-rich country. 60% of our housing stock is single-family homes, 78 million of them. And by definition, they all have a yard, single-family detached houses, and yet people just don't garden very much. It used to be a totally normal part of running a household. This is the famous vegetable terrace at Monticello. And this is a somewhat more modest house in the rural South. You know, obviously, you know, the total poverty, and yet the garden is gorgeous. So the USDA actually keeps figures on the dollar value of home production and as a percentage of the total we spend on food at home. And this is from 1869 to 2010. And you know, basically the trend is steady decline. So they recently revised this chart. It used to be even more dramatic, heading down towards 1%, but they're using a new data source after 1987. So they say that we're somewhere, we get somewhere around 3.5% of our food by dollar value from home production and donations. So even though vegetable gardening is becoming very fashionable, and every time I meet anybody in Gen Y, I have tremendous hope that the culture is going to shift, and community gardens in cities are completely inspiring, you can see we don't really see a trend upward yet. So personally, I would like to send the line upward, or at least do my part. So I'm fascinated by the question of why not? In a place where we have all this land and every reason to garden, why don't people garden in the backyard? Weeds, a mulch will take care of those. So I think the main reason is because we have a couple of generations that didn't engage in gardening in a big way. You know, the generation that grew up during World War II, you know, they were involved in victory gardens, which the USDA says during the war produced 40% of the country's fresh produce. That's amazingly impressive. This is a victory garden at a New York City school, and it might even be the school my dad went to. This is my dad in 1946. He grew up in Queens in the most urban way possible, playing stickball in the street and dragging the mattress out onto a fire escape on hot summer nights, just like in the Ouija photo. And he vividly remembers working the victory garden at the Catholic school he attended as a school project. But the war ended, and he never went near the dirt again. So I think my mother is actually an even more interesting example, because she actually grew up on a farm. It's a kind of dreadfully charmless farm with nasty flies and low ceilings and a terrible smell of manure in the house. And it was her bad fortune to grow up in a time and a place where the fact that you had parents who farmed didn't mean that you wouldn't nearly starve to death, because she grew up in Hitler's Germany. And so her experience at the war was not comparable in misery to what Jewish children were suffering at the same moment, but it was really not blithe. I mean, she remembers bombers whining overhead, nothing to eat but lard on stale bread, unannounced inspections by the Gestapo that threatened to have her father dragged away. It was not fun. So the war ended, and at the age of 12, my mother had the chance to go away to school, and she basically took off like a rocket and never went back. In her mid-20s, she moved to New York City, and in her 30s, she settled in suburban splendor in New Jersey, where we had an enormous yard of 2 acres, big sunny spot, perfect for a vegetable garden, only she didn't do a garden. So I have one childhood memory of her going to the last surviving dairy farm in my suburbanizing town and getting a bushel basket of manure because she wanted to grow rhubarb. But rhubarb, which is probably the most indestructible of edible crops, she mowed it over the next year. I think the manure finished her off. Her whole life is about putting the greatest possible distance between herself and the manure. So anyway, to this generation, I think the idea there was nothing more seductive than the idea of leaving the old ways behind. And really, they had excellent reasons. I mean, you know, they came of age during came of age during the Great Depression, when the poorest people in the country could be seen eating out of garbage cans. And this photo is of a bread line at the base of the Brooklyn Bridge. Then they had to experience either the horrors of war or of saying goodbye to their young men. Food was rationed in order for there to be sufficient food from the troops. And the basic feeling was one of intense deprivation, I think, because Americans were allotted 2.5 pounds of meat per person under food rationing, 2.5 pounds of meat per week under food rationing, which sounds like quite a lot to me. The rationing inspired black markets and conspiracy theories, and you know, people felt deprived. So another aspect of this deprivation was a severe housing shortage. Basically, there hadn't been any new housing built since the onset of the Great Depression. And inspired, I'm sure, by the fact that, you know, by the dangers their young men would soon be facing, young couples started reproducing at a startling rate. And by 1947, there were 6 million families in America shoehorned in with their relatives. There was just no housing for them. And many of them made do with temporary housing. This is the temporary housing at a GE defense plant during the war. But the GI Bill guaranteed low interest loans on homes. And so basically, American families fled the cities for the suburbs by the millions as soon as developers could slap together the capes and ranches to house them. So for many of these people, they now had a yard, their first chance to grow food, only largely they didn't. Vegetable gardening was not encouraged by the developers of many of these neighborhoods. The Levittown Homeowners Association Guide is a fascinating document. It has pages and pages of micro instructions for lawn care, shrub care, weeding, and absolutely nothing for vegetable gardening. And the basic thrust of the Levittown Homeowners Guide is shabbiness prevention. The word unsightly and shabby appears a lot. But the truth is, you know, Americans were, you know, shabbiness prevention suited them just fine after the war. They were not really interested in scrabbling for a living with the chickens in the backyard because they'd been scrabbling for 2 decades and were hardly sick of it. So basically, you had a generation that wanted to live lives that were clean and factory made, move from air-conditioned cars to air-conditioned houses as pristine as spaceships. It was a new world, and you cannot blame them. So obviously, there's a lot of money to be made in doing something for people that they previously would have done for themselves. All these self-service supermarkets sprang up everywhere. The self-service supermarket had been invented decades earlier, but it only really took off after the war. And the thing that really sold these places was the incredible array of convenience foods they were now offering. And so a car-based suburban life encouraged, you know, sort of a less frequent shopping and, you know, so a more of a reliance on the already preserved and prepared. And then you also had the technological angle. Refrigerators now routinely included a freezer compartment. You could buy the frozen stuff and live quite nicely. So convenience was not a post-war invention. So this list comes from Daniel Boorstin's incredible intellectual history, The Americans, the Democratic Experiences, the final volume. And so Boorstin points out like how many methods of basically preserving food, bringing it to places out of season were perfected here. And to me, the most interesting is that Gail Borden, who perfected the canning of condensed milk, he was inspired by the Donner Party. They were pioneers who were snowed in the Sierras for a winter and forced to eat their dead companions. And so anyway, he didn't want that to happen again. So he figured out condensed milk. So Boorstin sees in this love of processed foods, he sees something special about our culture and our economy. You know, seasonality, yes, that's one thing. That was, you know, life was based on seasonality. But Boorstin talks about the American democracy of times and places that basically makes one place equivalent to another and one time equivalent to another. And what he's really saying is that, you know, any luxury, this is something we specialize in as Americans, if you name any luxury, some clever entrepreneur will figure out how to bring it to everybody at every moment. And this includes the incomparable luxury of a fragrant strawberry in season. So here we go, freeze-dried in the cereal box, ready to go. So, you know, never mind that the strawberry's probably given up that fragrance in the course of being processed, transported, and sold. I mean, taste is not the point of convenience foods. I think we can all agree on that. Basically, by the 50s, over 700 chemicals were being used to manipulate foods that had already been manipulated into pablum. So they taste horrible. They always have tasted horrible. That's not the point. So I actually question whether time saved is really the point of convenience foods. I'm fascinated by this chart. It's basically the per capita time adults spend on housework from 1900 to 2005. And you can see that despite like this incredible explosion of labor-saving appliances and foods that didn't really need to be cooked, we still spend about the same amount of time every week on housework. So there are two reasons for that. One of the things that's happened is that we spend more time with our children, particularly men. That's a beautiful thing. Although the economist who did this research kind of growled at me and said, you know, those kids would be better off if we spent less time driving them to soccer practice and more time cooking them a meal. So, you know, but basically a good thing. But the other thing that's happened is that we've really traded the creative aspects of housework, like gardening and cooking, for a load of crap. Like sitting in your SUV, navigating traffic, getting to a supermarket, pushing a cart around its miles of aisles. You know, I mean, I'm completely convinced that by saving me shopping trips, my vegetable garden saves me time. So, okay, so money saved is also not an argument for choosing convenience foods over the fresh and homegrown. And by the 1930s, this was true even in the poorest rural areas in America. And so basically, like, poor Appalachian farmers wouldn't want to eat their country hams. They'd rather eat the watery canned variety. And they would sell homegrown vegetables in order to buy canned goods. So obviously, convenience foods, however, obviously they did something or nobody would have bought them. And basically, Boorstin argues that national brands helped people feel like they were part of the modern world. They helped them belong. And this was incredibly important in a big, lonely, diverse country like the United States, where you had these lonely farmers in lonely hollows, immigrants pouring in from all parts of the world, There were a lot of American eccentrics, and they, by buying national brands, they felt that they had joined the culture. So my mother, of course, was one of these eccentric immigrants, but to her infinite credit, she wasn't buying this at all. So I never got Wonder Bread like my peers did. I grew up on crusty bakery rye, and I never got to eat ragu spaghetti sauce. She made homemade spaghetti sauce with meatballs stuffed with garlic and fresh herbs. And so anyway, and the problem was I would go to my friends' houses and I really couldn't stomach the ragu. So she made me eccentric too, and I was kind of bitter about that as a child, although aglow from the quality of the food I ate. So we had this generation that sort of actively turned away from this kind of, you know, life of subsistence. But they've been followed by generations with different ideas of progress that are not necessarily about removing oneself from the natural world, and certainly more interesting ideas about food. And yet there's never been a big revival of the kitchen garden. Maybe we're on the cusp of one, I'm not entirely sure. So the question is, like, if gardening is as enjoyable as I say it is, why hasn't there been a revival? And I really think it's because if ever there were a cultural activity that rewards continuity across the generations, it's gardening. If you take up cooking and you have no one to advise you, you know, you have a couple of bad meals. But if you take up gardening without any advice, well, you know, you could waste a whole season of labor and have something very ugly to look at as well. So gardening is best learned from old sages. It's almost entirely local. So while the basic principles are simple and universal, you know, the question of what will be successful in your neighborhood, when to plant it, how to harvest it, all that stuff is best communicated by thoughtful neighbors, in my opinion. And so there weren't, for many years in America, there weren't a lot of vegetable gardens to inspire people, and there weren't a lot of old sages to say, hey, this is not that hard, I'll show you how to do it. So now we've arrived at this interesting moment where the old sages, some of whom happen to be young and attractive, are actually renting themselves out as garden coaches. And anyway, so you know, here's the beauty of our economy demonstrated once more. Every luxury makes its way out into a wider market, including the luxury of advice from an experienced vegetable gardener. Okay, so if you don't have a thoughtful neighbor to teach you how to garden, so who are you going to turn to? So maybe you'll turn to the merchants. Maybe you'll just, you know, you'll go to a nursery and try to learn how to do a vegetable garden from there. So if you're like me in Saratoga Springs, where there are not a lot of independent nurseries, basically this means going to a big box store. And to me, I never sort of, this is the Home Depot in my town, I never see that gate without thinking, abandon all hope ye who enter here. So if you were looking for your first cues about gardening in this place, you would basically conclude that it's nothing but a battle against vermin. You know, they sell a handful of organic products, but that's not the dominant culture of the place. Battle is. So, you know, can we be less subtle? Total Kill is the name of this brand. So the ortho, it's not using this slogan anymore, but last year it had a slogan, defend what's yours, family, home, and yard. I mean, you know, so are we talking about unauthorized wiretapping, or are we talking about gardening, you know? So I always think that these places are like Fox News. They try to rile you up into a state of paranoia in order to keep you interested. And, you know, and it's not just the branding that's weird in these places, it's also the subliminal clues. I mean, they smell terrible, all these chemicals, you know. It's like, you know, visiting the loading dock in hell. So, and when the branding is not aggressively military, sometimes it's about, you know, curing disease. So I love this, Immunox. You know, it's like the best bland tradition of pharmaceutical nomenclature. And indeed, Bayer, which, you know, makes the most benign of medicines, aspirin, is also a big player in this pesticide market. So anyway, so basically, if you went into one of these stores, you would conclude that vegetable gardening is either a battle against pests or a delightful opportunity to minister to the inherent sickness of nature. But what these merchants don't tell you is that you can happily garden for decades without employing one of their big guns. Basically, well-managed vegetable gardens are healthy. There's very few problems that can't be solved by fencing or picking the bug off. And, you know, when a crop doesn't succeed and you've done everything right, you shrug. Maybe it's not meant to be. So then we have the more organic merchants. I actually have a problem with them, too, because they offer so many specialized soil amendments and pesticides and specialized equipment that, you know, they could make your head spin. I mean, am I supposed to use the energy buttons or the all-purpose fertilizer? I don't know. And basically, they basically try to get the gardener's money by saying you need specialized tools. And the implication is specialized knowledge and a lot of wearying attention in order to succeed in a vegetable garden. So I've been gardening for 20 years, and 20 years of gardening have turned me into a complete minimalist. I don't use anything except for mulch, seeds, and a shovel. Thank you. So the truth is we don't need all this fertilizer. If you add organic matter to your soil, the soil microbes will basically give your plants what they need. Okay, so say you don't have a neighbor to advise you. The merchants have let you down. So what are you going to do? You're going to turn to books. And so I don't mean to sound bitter, but I really hate the how-to literature of vegetable gardening. And it's kind of personal because I feel like I read a lot of books when I was a beginning gardener and they abused my innocence. So the first advice in most gardening books, why I think vegetable gardening, however, is not a natural subject for a how-to. I feel like it's a principle, not a rule-based activity. The principles are incredibly simple. Lots of sun, fertile soil, sufficient water, okay? Barely fill a paragraph. So I'm a professional writer. I understand padding. So you need lots of padding if you're trying to fill out a whole how-to book once you get beyond those three things. But there's also the specific factors, such as the relationship between a crop, a spot, a climate, and a human personality, are so variable as to be completely infinite. All gardening advice, by definition, is contingent. And the problem I have with gardening books is they tend to try to be exhaustive. They don't accept their own contingency. And basically, they try to cover every eventuality, solve every problem. And the beginning gardener opens up these 500-page books and assumes that gardening is nothing but a series of problems. So the first piece of advice is send your soil to a lab to be tested. So I actually did once send soil to a lab to be tested. I made a garden on a corner at my daughter's school where school buses had been idling since 1920, and I felt I needed to test for lead. Soil was fine. So I would test for lead or industrial waste if you suspect them. But I mean, the rest of this, you know, pH, nutrient recommendations, you know, it's not a chemistry experiment. It's a relationship with nature that's generally proved successful for the last 10,000 years. So until you perceive that you have a problem, I wouldn't bother. So here's another thing that bothers me about the literature of vegetable gardening. It's full of authoritative charts. So this is a planting chart that drives me crazy. I mean, so I lived in Los Angeles when I was young, and I can tell you that March in Los Angeles and March in upstate New York are not the same month. So where are we talking about here? I have a friend who does a vegetable garden in Atlanta. She tells me that there are two seasons. There's a winter-spring season and a fall season, but in the middle are like, you know, a couple of summer months when it's like wiltingly hot and nothing wants to grow. So anyway, I find this chart completely useless. There are also charts about the pH requirements of various vegetables. Very, very specific. But you know, the truth is most vegetables will grow in any good garden soil with a range from slightly acidic to slightly alkaline. If you're not having a problem, why worry about it? And the other thing that people don't know is that earthworms excrete calcium carbonate, which is the ingredient in lime. So, and another kind of chart that you often see is the water requirements of various vegetables. And I mean, I really don't think that's designed to do anything except provoke anxiety in the beginning gardener. I mean, doesn't common sense suffice? If the soil is dry, water, if you've had a soaking rain, maybe don't. And so, so in the camp of dubious advice, this is the sort of king, which is, you know, basically till your soil. You know, ideally, if you're really energetic, you know, double dig it. And I think this is the single piece of advice that's driven more people screaming out of the garden than any other. So double digging is about going down 2 feet deep and moving the soil in layers. And if you've ever tried to do this in clay or rocky soil, I mean, it's impossible. And so basically, my feeling about this is before you recommend something like this, you better be damn sure it's necessary. However, there's no science really supporting the idea that yields are better under double digging. And common sense suggests that it's almost certainly counterproductive because you're interrupting the life in the soil. You're cutting up the mycelia, which are the fungal networks that are so important to plant growth. Destroying the worm tunnels, da-da-da. I mean, you're just sort of making a mess of the place. So thank goodness Patricia Lanza has sort of popularized this lasagna gardening idea, which is basically about not tilling at all, just mulching your garden with organic matter and enriching it that way. And certainly that's my method, and it works incredibly well. But you know, whatever the scientific virtues of this, it at least has the merit of being something that could be attempted by somebody with a day job. So I'm very pro mulch. So there's a lot of pseudoscience in gardening advice, and this is my friend Jeff Gilman, who's an actual scientist. He's a horticulturist at the University of Minnesota. And I love him because he actually writes books that talk to gardeners, explain science to gardeners. And if you ask him, like, why the quality of the advice gardeners get in the literature is so poor, he'll tell you that there's basically not been a lot of research directed at the questions of the home garden. Most research is federally and state funded. The USDA is not interested in your little backyard garden. They're interested in the needs of big ag. And the goals of industrial agriculture are just completely different from the goals of the backyard garden. But now there's more money available for organic gardening, maybe more applicable to the backyard garden. So maybe there'll be better science here. So this is the advice that I got when I started gardening, that I got out of books. So double dig, test the soil, add the right amendments, till annually. Pay attention to the requirements of individual crops and side dress the broccoli. I actually had a life, so I did none of this stuff. But for years, I felt like a second rater. You know, if only I had time for all this stuff, I would actually be a good gardener. And then one day, I sort of looked around and realized that I took a ton of gorgeous food out of a garden that was utterly beautiful to look at, and none of this stuff was in any way necessary. Not at all. So if you ask the guy whose garden coaching website I showed you earlier, what advice he gives to beginners, he basically says, feed the soil, not the plants, which is the classic organic movement advice. And that's good advice. I mean, it's like basically take care of the context and the details will take care of themselves. But this is my friend Martha Colleton. I know a lot of really good cooks, but she towers above them all. She was a professional chef. She's written cookbooks. She's a complete scholar of food. And she has an enormous vegetable garden that she's delightfully unsentimental about. It's basically fodder for her kitchen. And if you ask her what kind of advice she would give beginners, she has an even more relaxed point of view, which is disturb a piece of earth, throw seeds on it, you'll get food. So I'm not saying here that you can't spend a lifetime refining your methods and understanding the timing requirements of various crops. I mean, I've spent 20 years really gripped by these questions. My point is just that it's not hard to start gardening. It's not hard to begin. And that if you're relaxed about it, you'll probably be successful right away. So my point is that it's not too time-consuming to gardening. It doesn't require specialized knowledge. It's, you know, not sweaty, blah, blah, blah. We don't garden for cultural reasons, not any other kind of reason. For generations now, the culture has insinuated that gardening is not part of modern life, and wouldn't we rather just get in our car and drive to the supermarket? So I think we need to seize this idea of convenience back from its post-war definition. I mean, we need to seize it back from the people who gave us inventions like the electric can opener and battery-powered knife. And people who knocked down historic neighborhoods in cities all over the country in order to build highways to truck tasteless food in from across the continent. Okay, that definition of convenience is really tired. And I also question whether our domestic life should only be about convenience, whether there should not be value judgments also. What's beautiful to do? What's joyful to do? But I want to tell you what I find convenient. So what I find convenient is ending a crazy work day having ingredients for dinner right there, not having to go shop for them, wandering out in the backyard to get them. I find that amazingly convenient. I also find it convenient, like, having ingredients at hand that are so good that they make up for my limitations as a cook. You know, during harvest season, I think I'm Alice Waters. You know, when I'm sort of buying store-bought food in, you know, February, you know, I'm more ordinary. The other thing that I think is really convenient is not having to worry about what's been sprayed on my food or what pathogens might be on them thanks to slovenly handling. And I think it's convenient, basically enjoying that piece of paradise called my yard. So I garden for many, many reasons. I save a lot of money. I think that I save a third of my annual food bill. Certainly, I do that in the 8 months when I'm really taking a lot of stuff out of my garden. So flavor is a great reason to garden. You know, health, it's like great exercise. You know, the experience of the soil is really a wonderful thing. I think my garden's beautiful. It's a great thing to do for my kids. I'm constantly learning. I've been doing it for 20 years. I'm not bored yet. And, you know, survival, it makes me laugh a little bit, but, you know, God knows what's coming down the pike. I mean, I'm pretty sure that I can grow enough food to feed my family no matter what. But the main reason, and maybe the best reason to garden, is that it really makes me happy. It's just beautiful to have that collaboration and connection with nature. So, thank you. Yes.
What do you do about deer?
Well, so you saw, that's my garden there with the cedar fence, and it's out in the country, and I'm not there during the week. But I have these iron arches from Smith and Hawken, and I think they freak the deer out. I have like maybe five of them in the garden, so I've never had a deer problem, even with a 4-foot fence. I did have a terrible groundhog problem that made me murderous. So I spent like a month on digging a trench and on my belly nailing cage wire to the bottom of the fence, and that solved that problem. So anyway, the deer thing works for me. I mean, I actually think that, you know, I probably save $4,500 a year on food with my vegetable garden. So, you know, if you have the capital up front, a fence is a great idea. Oh, good, good. We have lots of deer there, and I never had a problem. Okay. Yes. I do, but I actually, you know, I have a job, so I find harvest season is incredibly intense, just like pulling in the food and storing it in the basement. Pardon me? Well, no, I start getting salad mash out of my garden in March, and this garden's in Washington County. So as soon as the snow retreats, it germinates in fall, so I have salads instantly. I mean, basically, I think for 8 months of the year, I save about $100 a week on my grocery bill. And so I do can some, I freeze some, but, you know, I'm not the world's best preserver. I actually find, you know, storing and cooking the food during harvest season quite intense. Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about how your garden
is self-perpetuating? We tried to garden in our backyard, and we would make it. I don't know how to make it continue from year to year, and I don't know how to get 8 months of produce out of my garden. Well, how my garden is self-perpetuating? Well, you know, perennial crops are really great in a vegetable garden. Things like rhubarb and arugula, I mean, sorry, rhubarb and asparagus that are there before a lot of other vegetables are there. And, you know, like I said, I have great luck with mosh, which self-seeds in my garden. I don't till my garden every year, so it seeds itself, and it's always there early in the spring. So I've never done this, but people have incredible success with hoop houses, passive solar greenhouses, cold frames. There are really a lot of vegetables that, you know, if you give them a little protection, will winter over. Oh, well, you know, lots of greens. Let me think of, you know, really tough stuff, kale. Spinach, yeah. So Elliot Coleman has written a book called The Four Season Harvest, and he gardens in Maine, or he has actually a market garden in Maine, and talks about this. Yeah.
How did you come up with the title?
I wanted to call my book Eat the Yard, but the publisher's lawyers said that there was some other thing called Eat the Yard, so I couldn't use that title. So I have a friend, actually, who's a famous headline writer for magazines. She's worked at a number of magazines, and she just brainstormed with me, and so she came up with Grow the Good Life. But I know that Helen and Scott Nearing have their, you know, Live the Good Life book, and people have asked me about that, but they didn't inspire that title. Yes?
How do you modify your speech for folks that might be in New York City?
How do I well, so I lived in Brooklyn when I was young, and I recently did a book-related event in Brooklyn, and I just couldn't believe, like, you know, the degree to which people were interested in, you know, urban agriculture. So, you know, there are community gardens everywhere. The weird thing is, I actually think that if you want to find signs of a sort of gardening movement, you'd be way better off going to a big city than to a suburb. I mean, people get it, you know, people garden in the Fenway in Boston, that's an ancient community garden. So, you know, if you don't have access to a community garden in New York, I would just say move. But if you do,
yeah.
Uh-huh. Well, so I think the reason community gardens are so successful is that you can grow a ridiculous amount of food in an incredibly small space. I mean, my first vegetable garden was 6 feet by 10 feet. I only grew tomatoes, basil, and arugula, and yet, you know, I had enough for, like, salads and pasta all summer long, fed lots of friends. I mean, you really can grow an intense amount of food in a limited space, so... Oh, one more question. Okay, yes.
What do you feel about community-supported agriculture? You're not farming, growing a garden in your own backyard, but supporting it through joining a CSA.
I think it's fantastic. I mean, you know, I'm not an agriculture expert, but I mean, my feeling, I find I have so few problems in growing food that it makes me think that one of the problems with agriculture is that it happens on the wrong scale. So I think supporting small farmers, local farmers, is fantastic. You know, you're not going to get the exercise benefits. You're not going to get the benefit of sort of, you know, being out there with, you know, digging in the dirt and contact with those soil microbes, which seem to protect against certain kinds of allergic and autoimmune diseases. You know, I mean, you won't get the full package, but I think local farmers are wonderful. So, and they're also a great source of information. I love going to the farmers market and pumping them for information. I know. Well, you know, I mean, it's hard to argue that, you know, an economic downturn is a good thing, but I do think it's made people rethink some of this. And the New York Times just ran a fabulous op-ed piece 2 weeks ago by a woman who, a single mother who lost her job and basically started gardening in her Brooklyn backyard because she was starving. I mean, she couldn't afford food for her kids. And she was not, you know, I'm a total foodie. She was not a foodie, but she started growing the food. And, you know, she concluded that it was really wonderful at the end, and all you had to be was hungry in order to do it. So, so yes, I do have some hope. And I really think that I'm totally amazed when I meet, you know, young people, how interested they are in this. I mean, if you go to the farmers market, I mean, a lot of those young farmers, they're, you know, college educated, you know, 25, gorgeous, you know, I think they're great. Yes.
How about an award for Michelle Obama?
Yeah, fantastic, right? Yeah, I mean, what a great cultural statement that is. Yeah, it's great. That, you know, even, you know, even, you know, a household as elegant as that, you know, sees some value in a backyard garden. It's great.
Well, I want to thank Michelle.